This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sociologist Annette Leroux spent years parked in the middle of the intimate lives of American families, upper middle class, working class, and poor. "Treat me like the family dog," she told them, as she watched up close how these families raised their children. What she found were large and consequential class distinctions in styles of child rearing, entitled middle-class kids scheduled to the max and taught to question authority, free and easy poor and working-class kids taught to love their families and obey. Each made sense, but the advantages flowing to the more affluent style, she says, are huge. Up next, On Point, a provocative new take on class and childhood in America. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Annette Leroux. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and fellow at the Center for the Advanced Study of the Behavioral Sciences, a California research institute. She's author of the new book, Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family Life. Annette Leroux, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is a really fascinating study and has been interpreted in very fascinating ways, including David Brooks recently on the editorial page of the New York Times. But tell us first what you did, how you did it, and begin to give us the outline of what you learned.
Well, we began in third grade classrooms, one in a northeastern city and one in a suburb. And we followed children around in the classrooms. And then there were 88 families where we did two-hour interviews with them, you know, for talking to the mom and then the dad, and trying to find out what they wanted for their children and how their children's daily lives went. But the most unusual part of the study is for 12 families, and they were half white and half black, and they were middle class, working class, and poor. We actually visited them in their homes. So we followed them around. We usually went every day for about 3 weeks, and there was usually one overnight visit. The families were paid for their participation, and most of the families came from the classrooms where we had done the observation.
And I love your description of how that worked. You said, treat us like the family dog. In other words, we'll sit in the corner, forget about us as much as you can, and we'll observe. And in observing, families chosen for the kind of array of class memberships that they represented, what did you find?
Well, the families took a while to get used to us, but we noticed that yelling went up and cursing went up on the third day and again on the 10th day. And there's actually quite a lot of yelling in the families with young children, because in the middle-class families, it was quite hectic. And so we found that the pace of life was different. And by middle class, we meant people who had a college degree and who had a job where they had some level of autonomy. So it wasn't based on income. The working class and poor people were mostly high school dropouts or high school graduates, and they worked in blue-collar jobs. And we just found that what it meant to be, all parents wanted their kids to be happy and to be healthy. But the middle class parents felt that they saw children as a project. And I use a gardening analogy, I call it concerted cultivation, where they tried to cultivate them. And they saw, they enrolled them in activities, but especially they reasoned with them. So they answered questions with questions. And they also supervised their daily lives in schools and with doctors, and they intervened frequently with them.
You're being, I think, rather modest about what you found here. It's kind of startling the way you put it. I mean, on the one hand, you've got this concerted cultivation where families are sort of speaking in a kind of instructive tone, interaction with their kids all the time. They're scheduled to the max. They're teaching their children by example and explicitly to question authority, to feel entitled, to step up, to look people in the eye when they speak to them, not to be intimidated in institutional situations. And all of that, you say, on the middle upper middle class side, adds up to real advantages.
That's correct. And in the working class families, there was more a sense of how kids used to be raised, that they played outside, they played with their cousins, they watched TV, parents gave them directives, they told them to cut it out. And then also they gave them autonomy. They presumed that teachers knew a lot more about teaching than they did, so they turned over responsibility to the school. But I worked very hard to say that these were not intrinsically better approaches, but what was better was that they had payoffs in institutions, because schools privilege language use. There was a African-American middle-class family where the father was a lawyer and the mom was a high-level executive, and they have this one boy who I call Alexander Williams. And we're sitting there in the dinner table after dinner, and he has to write a riddle. And he's joking around, and his dad says, well, you could go upstairs and copy it out. And he says, well, that's a good idea. And then his dad said, that's not an option. And then someone says that would be plagiarism. And then there's a talk. I mean, plagiarism is a word that could appear on the SAT. And here he's 10 years old, and he's learning it just after family dinner hour.
You also write a lot about attitudes toward authority, the upper middle class kids being encouraged to kind of talk back, question, interact, reason with the adults around them, their parents typically. And kids in working class and poorer families having a much more directed life at one level where they're used to getting orders.
That's correct. And middle class kids were often very rude to their parents. I had research assistants who helped me, including African American research assistants and white research assistants. And it turned out the research assistant's own family background very much mattered. So that I had this one young man who grew up in a working class home, and he could not believe how rude the middle class kids were to their parents. And they would say, I hate you, don't do that. You always get it wrong, you know, denigrating their parents when they're 10 years old. And the parents just, they didn't like it, and whining. Whining was just incredibly common in the middle class homes. And we did not hear even very little kids, 3 and 4 year old kids in working class and poor homes whine. It just was not there.
So the interaction around power in the families of fewer means?
That's right. The kids had more autonomy. They would play outside, they'd watch TV, they just hung out. And in some ways, they had a chance to be more creative, to have very strong relationships with their cousins and also with children in the neighborhood.
I have to say, the childhood you describe sounds something more like the idyllic childhood of our storybook Mind's Eye in the poorer families. They, you know, the sort of free hours to create and invent and be with one another, be with extended family, the kind of freedom and interaction with each other they had sound much more like the Peter Pan world than this sort of regimented, let's go, stack up the accomplishments in the middle class.
Well, I guess there are two things to say about that. First, money was extremely tight in the working class and poor homes. The neighborhoods were, you know, difficult. And the children felt keenly the lack of money. So children often talked about money. They asked, was there any money left over when the parents went to the grocery store? The kids were extremely aware of how difficult their parents' lives were, and they often didn't make requests. You know, you go to the store with middle-class kids, and they say, oh, I want this, I want that, and the working-class and poor kids would be completely quiet. They would very rarely ask.
And out of these different childhoods come different sort of kit bags of skills and attitudes. How would you define what the middle-class kids come away with, what the working and poor-class kids come away with as they step into adult life from these backgrounds, this child-rearing?
Well, the middle-class kids get extensive training in school-related activities. They get extensive training in language use and verbal interaction and how to not take no for an answer in an institution and how to maneuver with institutions. And they have a lot of informal knowledge about how institutions work. And working-class and poor parents have more of a distrust of the school. The parents worried a great deal that the school would come take their kids away. And even teachers see that very rare. It does happen. And the school is, in fact, an arm of the state. And so working class and poor parents and kids were more distrustful of schools and doctors. And they had a sense of feeling they felt less empowered to make things happen in the way that they wanted it to happen.
There's a lot more we're going to look at here. We're going to be joined in a moment as well by Charles Willey, a great figure in looking at how families work at young ages at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. But let me ask you, David Brooks, conservative editorialist opinion writer for the New York Times, looks at your research. He's very admiring of it, and the conclusion he takes away from it is this: in his words, today's rich don't exploit the poor; they just outcompete them. What do you make of that interpretation?
Well, I would beg to differ with Mr. Brooks on that point. I think the issue is how schools are organized and how the society is organized. We, you know, Sweden gives kids a child allowance, and America has much more childhood poverty than does Europe. And so the way that the structures of society are organized matter a great deal. That said, in the United States, we have a pyramid, and we have very few good jobs at the top, and we have very few slots at Harvard. And so America has always been stratified. In early part of the century, there was a huge Italian problem in the schools, in the way that we think that there are problems with some black kids in schools today. And so we've always had a stratified society, and middle-class parents are more likely to keep pace with the ever-changing standards of childhood.
Did you see a difference in love, in caring between the classes in childrearing?
I really didn't. In fact, one of the things that, you know, we all live in neighborhoods and we go to certain parts of neighborhoods and we don't go to others. And part of what made it this study difficult to do was you'd get a headache if you would go from very in San Francisco, to go to a very prosperous neighborhood and then go to a very poor neighborhood, which were often less than an hour apart. But once you were there, they all felt like home. They all felt kind of, once you got used to being there, they felt comfy and they felt safe. And even families that were very difficult, they just felt like home. And all the parents wanted the best for their children.
I've been joined by Annette Leroux. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. Her book is Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family. I'm joined right now as well in the studio by Charles Willey, professor emeritus at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. He's written extensively on race, socioeconomic status, education, and family relations. He's co-author with Richard Reddick of A New Look at Black Families. Charles Willey, thank you so much for being with us.
It's nice to be with you.
So here we are. We want to live in that country of the American dream where anybody can get anywhere. We know there's a lot of history here. We know it's never been as simple as that. Annette Leroux and her research associates have gone into homes, and they believe they see very different styles of child rearing in different classes, and that puts kids on tracks right at the get-go. Now, there's a whole world of school and preschool and income and all the rest, but what's your observation on this fundamental issue of styles of child rearing and advantages and disadvantages that it gives kids?
Well, first, I like her study. It's very in-depth and complete, but I do have some problems with interpretations, and I think her interpretations are not different from mine, but I emphasize the contribution that all social class groups can make to the society at large. And I think one of our great errors is to think that the middle class has found a way of adapting to society in a way that would help others. I think the middle class needs to learn how to use some of the techniques that the poor and the working class people use, and working class and poor people need to learn some of the techniques that middle class people use. And I think if one looks at it from that point of view, one can see that each of these class groups and each of these racial groups mm-hmm. has something to give to the whole society. Let me give you just one example.
Please.
My studies looking at poor people taught me something that is very important. Justice is an important concept in any social organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the white poor know a great deal about contributive justice. What is the individual's responsibility to the group?
Mm-hmm.
The black poor know a great deal about distributive justice. What's the responsibility of the group to the individual? You need both contributive and distributive justice. And if we look at black poor and white poor, they both have solved a problem that others have not solved. Mm. Likewise with the working class.
Mm-hmm.
I will stop after this example so we mm-hmm. can have some other discussion. But the working class are quite interested. The working class families who are black want their children to only look to the future. They don't want them to look back and see from whence they came.
Don't look back.
Mm-hmm. Working class whites also want their children to have a better life than they had and want them to be successful,
mm-hmm.
but they don't want them to forget the base from which they came. Now, I call the base from which they came the past, faith, and I call the future hope.
Mm.
Any society needs both faith and hope, and if we are wise enough, we will look at black working class families and understand how to maintain hope, and we'll look at white working class families and understand how to maintain faith in the past. The two go together.
I like the way you're expanding the canvas here, bringing in the human terms. And Annette Leroux does as well, saying, look, in the working and class and poor families, you've got very close family bonds, much more likely to know their extended family well, to be there for them, a kind of freedom that children have. On the other hand, if we look at this in terms of the American dream in this kind of class terms or earning and incomes and status terms, she's describing middle class kids who, you know, come out of here with just sort of, ready to rock. Families actively fostering talents, opinions, and skills, scheduling their children, reasoning with them, you know, hovering around them, intervening on their behalf. You're describing a kind of humanistic value in all these corners. But do we see one part of society really advantaged just by that style of child rearing and another disadvantage when it comes to where they're going to end up in this society?
You're correct, and she's correct on that. But it also has some implications in terms of public policy. I like John Rawls' position. Mm. He's now deceased, mm-hmm. Political philosopher, who mm-hmm. said that none of us deserves our starting place in life, so we are all obligated to give compensating advantages to those who missed out. It is not the middle class should be able to take it all because of what they do for their children. It is the middle class needs to teach children how to give compensating advantages to those who missed out. Now, to give compensating advantages, it may mean you have to have desegregated schools where there's a pluralistic population in each school, where all class groups can learn from each other. I don't like to talk about this without bringing in the institutions in society which have to work with children, because it lets some people go away thinking that if you're middle class, mm-hmm. everything is all right. Mm-hmm. I have studied middle class people, and I will tell you, mm-hmm. everything is not all right. I live in the suburbs, mm-hmm. first time I've mm-hmm. ever lived in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I moved there so I could see whether everything was all right. And I don't think everything is all right in the inner city, and everything is not all right in the suburbs. Many of the youngsters who wreaked mayhem on schools were middle-class white children.
Columbine.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to talk down mm-hmm. about what they have done, but I want to suggest that there are good activities and good strategies in the middle class, and there are good activities and good strategies mm-hmm. in the poor. I myself, for example, grew up in a working-class family.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
There were five siblings. All siblings went to college. Mm-hmm. I've been at Harvard for 31 years as a professor and now professor emeritus. So the strategies that my family used might be helpful to some middle-class families, mm-hmm. and the strategies that middle-class families use may be helpful to people like my family.
Mm-hmm. And good for you, and we applaud it. At the same time, we're reading just this week, there's a flood of new studies out talking about young black males in worse situation than ever in this country. Inner cities where finishing high school is the exception. Legal work scarcer than ever. Prison almost routine. And we've got a scary picture here. Annette Leroux, what about Charles Willie's big picture? He says, look, there are advantages both ways here, and we should look fundamentally to institutions. Do you agree that there advantages, equal advantages in both styles? Can institutions solve this, or what are you proposing? That we put a Mrs. Doubtfire in every disadvantaged family in the country to talk with the kids, schedule them around, take them to soccer games?
I think the institutions are critical because, really, schools are quite narrow-minded in what kinds of activities and family lives that they see as legitimate. And, for example, for young black kids in the schools that I've been in, the African-American teachers felt very strongly that white teachers were less patient with the young black boys compared to the white boys, and that they were more likely to be punitive and to demonize them and to see them as adult kids rather than just being mischievous and little.
But is the school, the institution, going to be a substitute, going to make up for in economic accomplishment opportunities what you're describing in the home situation, child rearing?
Well, schools are the primary pathway to the labor force. And so if you graduate from high school, you are better poised to enter the labor force. Every year of education improves people's earnings.
Well, sure, but I see you describing middle-class kids who are from the home front prepared to succeed exactly in those schools that put them on into those jobs.
That is true, and I think being middle-class gives you more opportunities to fail. In the book, I do have a chapter about a young white middle-class girl who had a very bad learning problem and had a lot of difficulty in school. And
more so opportunities to fail, but I read you saying overwhelmingly that the real more is more opportunities to succeed.
That's correct. In other words, you can fail and your parents will still help send you to law school, help you out as you're older, mm-hmm. that they have more resources to help you bounce back from failures. And you can I think that's what middle-class parents are able to give to their kids.
Elizabeth is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment. I have a middle-class family with a daughter, middle school-age daughter, And some summers ago, over the course of 2 years, we hosted fresh air children, inner city children who are sent out.
Great.
One of our fresh air children came from a very large family, obviously many children, and the only worldview she saw for herself going forward was to have more children. You know, there are regular discussions at my dinner table about income and choices with income and career choices. None of this was within her purview. She really saw no reason to continue in school. And I remember a very pointed conversation in my car one day where I said to her, you know, you have choices. And if you drop out of school and go have the children you talk about, you know, you're looking at a life of minimum wage. If you stick it out and maybe you go to law school, maybe you end up charging $125 or $300 an hour.
Elizabeth, are you so sure that she didn't actually know she had those options, that she wasn't kind of putting you on in your suburban rounds?
Her jaw dropped. She had no idea that real numbers were connected to those choices. And I think that's the piece a lot of the kids are missing.
A piece that you say that they get at your dinner table, but maybe not at your young friends there. Charles Willie, what do you make of this story?
I think we need more research on people like the young woman that mm-hmm. the caller mentioned, and see what they do 10, 20, 25 years down the road. I think there is a great deal more success going on among people who had terrible beginnings than we know. And we've got to stop using single cases and generalizing mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. that. I would not say all people in the suburbs would be like our caller. Neither should you think that all blacks should be like this one person who came up in the fresh air program.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. And also, we know that while families may not be able to provide some of the opportunities to students, they have mentors. I had mentors. My mentor decided that I needed to get a Ph.D. degree, mm-hmm. not my family members.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have people in schools where they can interact with each other, middle-class people can learn from poor people, and poor people can learn from middle-class people, then you have a chance for the good things in each of these class groups to be learned. When we keep educating our people separately, as we have done, we have forgotten that Brown asked us to integrate schools for the reason that this wonderful study has pointed out, where students who can learn from each other when they're in a desegregated place. We don't have desegregation anymore, which is a failure of the institution. And these institutions need to take their responsibility to help people at different levels. The institutions also need to help middle-class people learn how not to focus on the individual only, but also to give back to the group.
Yeah, but then here's Annette LaRoe looking even before school age. Let's turn to Lansing, Michigan, and Jill. Hi, Jill, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what do you know?
Hi. Well, I was raised more working class and went to college, and my parents encouraged me, but they didn't know what that encouragement meant. So I think when you talk about that talk at the dinner table, it was like, go to college. And I felt when I got there, lots of people had an assumption of privilege, assumption of college, assumption of it being paid for, and I came with a very different perspective. I will say, having gotten educated, I feel like it was mentors and my own, you know, means that I got there, but I really appreciate that perspective of having both.
Jill, did you feel yourself coming from a different background? Was it clear to you in the attitudes and approaches to social life, to college work that you saw in kids around you, or not?
I mean, I'm pretty socially savvy, so I caught mm-hmm. up. But for example, you know, I didn't have tennis courts in my town, and everyone could play tennis. For example, when I went on a weekend away with some people, I couldn't play tennis with them.
Right. But you made it in. You made it over, even as you saw their different expectations. Jill, thanks for your call. Annette LaRoe, you've been listening here. So many questions. I mean, first, just to Jill's call, that you write extensively about the sense of entitlement among these middle and upper middle class kids. Is that an advantage or not?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, when we would go to little pizza parties when kids were 10, and the middle class kids did not think it was special. And the middle class kids at 10 seemed kind of bored. They would easily proclaim themselves to be bored, and they would complain to their mothers, and they wanted their mothers, they'd like, Mom, I'm bored, and they expected their mothers to help entertain them. And working class and poor kids, even though they were exactly the same age, they seemed younger. So pizza, they were very excited about it. The spring concerts, they'd be like, hi, Mom. And they had a lightness of spirit that the middle class kids, who seemed more adult-like. I mean, I have followed these young people, and they're now 20 and 21, and I would say the pattern is now reversed. The middle class kids seem younger. They're in college. And the working class kids have mostly dropped out of high school or high school grads, and they're working, and they seem more weighed down by life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Annette, what about the role of institutions here and how much we can generalize? I mean, you've done 12 families. Charles mm-hmm. Willie says, be careful. People are succeeding from many sectors here. Be careful of generalizing. And yet you've made an academic effort here that's quite considerable to do just that.
Well, I think we mean many studies, but I think the statistical research is pretty clear that one of the best predictors of SAT scores, for example, is your mother's education. And even little kids who are 4 years old know more letters and numbers if their mothers have a college degree than if their mothers are high school graduates. But on the other hand, there are always some families, maybe a quarter or something, it's hard to know, who have a different pathway even though they're in the same social class. So there's always variability within social class. But when I started to do this study, I thought people who were poor working class would be very focused on people who were middle class and vice versa, and that turned out not to be the case. People tended to compare themselves within the same group. So, for example, we had this one kid, who I called Harold McAllister, African-American kid who lives in a housing project. And this kid did not do homework. And the teachers were apoplectic, but the mom figured it was the teacher's job to get the kid to do homework. Because she figured, kind of like you wouldn't tell a surgeon how to do surgery, it was up to the teachers to mm-hmm. educate the kid. Mm-hmm. So she had a different idea about education, which the teachers tended not to respect. But what she said, I'm a good mom. There are moms in this housing project who are on dope, who aren't taking good care of their kids, and I'm taking good care of my kids. And similarly, middle-class parents tend to compare themselves to people who had more money, who did traveling teams to other states, and they said, oh, we don't do that. I mean, I could not find a single middle-class kid who did not have any activities. I wanted to find a middle-class kid who stayed home, had a life similar to a working-class kid, who watched TV, unlimited, hung out, played with their cousins, and I just couldn't find a kid like that.
I've been joined by sociologist Annette Leroux. She is professor of sociology at University of Maryland, author of Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family, and with me in the studio, Charles Willie, professor emeritus at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, co-author of A New Look at Black Families. Sam is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts right now. Hi, Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think there's something that's missing in this conversation, and it's implicit, but I'd like to make it explicit.
Please.
And that is that class doesn't exist in a vacuum. And in our country, it exists in the context of a consumer culture that's completely dominated by corporate interests. So from the minute you were born, there's no freedom to opt out of this. And the school systems, like everything else in our society, are oriented towards satisfying the needs of a corporate consumer culture.
So freedom to opt out of what exactly, Sam?
Well, you can't opt out of a consumer culture. What are you going to do, go put up a tent somewhere? I mean, you were born into this system that's a corporate consumer culture. I live next door to Concord. Thoreau understood this. We don't understand this anymore. So the point I'm trying to make is that the purpose of school is to create replacement parts for this corporate consumer culture.
So what do you see?
Education is about resupplying the system with workers. It's not about learning about literature. I mean, that's living in a pipe dream.
So whose childhood would you rather have? I mean, the case that's being made here is that middle-class, upper-middle-class kids are being prepped in the way they're raised to succeed in this economy, certainly, whether it's interpreted as you do as the corporate consumer culture or not. On the other hand, working-class, poor kids, not. So which way are you sending your kids?
Well, I think the important point is that only a certain amount of people can make it. And by make it, I mean have a lifestyle that affords you more of life's necessity. And that's by design. There's no choice here. That's the design. There are only a certain amount of slots at Harvard University. That's not going to change anytime soon. My child, I want him to, I'm trying to raise my son to appreciate life and appreciate that there are other things in life besides consuming, you know, and that the important thing is how much time do things take? And those are things that we're really not talking about in this conversation, I think because we're so embedded in it, we don't see how completely we're dominated by this conveyor belt to go through education and then get a job.
And go make the buck, Sam. We've got it. I want to ask both Annette Leroux and Charles Willey. Annette, first to you. Do you see, I don't know if you share Sam's interpretation, but do you see, let's say, working class and poorer families pushing their kids hard to go and make the big buck, or are they closer to Thoreau in the woods?
Well, we did see, I mean, going back to the other caller, we did see working class and poor parents who wanted their kids to graduate, to do well. And even when people ended up, young women ended up getting pregnant at 16, the mothers were extremely disappointed. They wanted their kids to have an apartment and to have a job and to have a life often that they didn't have. But the market was very powerful, and many of the houses were just filled with stuff, especially the middle-class families, and it took a lot of work to keep track of kids' objects. And a lot of time of the day was spent running around looking for things, and this was partly for organized activities. To go to soccer, you need a shiny pair of green shorts, you need your leggings, you need... And then the moms, so the moms were the ones who were really responsible for this, especially keeping the house going and keeping track of consumer objects of the kids and of the adults.
Stuffed with stuff. Charles Willey, what about this issue of what measure we should be holding up against ourselves, our children, in terms of success? Sam says, don't measure it in terms of dollars in the pocket to go out and buy more stuff. On the other hand, that is how we measure success in this country very often.
I don't. I don't know the nation that he's talking about, because that nation belongs to me. And I don't believe that human society is about getting more stuff. It will be about getting more stuff if everyone lets that theme that one finds in one class dominate the whole situation. What I have found is that no society and no community is effective unless there are people who live in that community who know how to serve others, unless there are people who know how to sacrifice in behalf of others, and unless there are people who know how to suffer the redemption of those who have had trouble in their life. Mm. So I think that if we had a community that had all of these three S's, then you would need all of the classes participating, because each has something to give the other.
But are the poor being raised then to serve and sacrifice? Should that fall on one class?
No, I said the middle class usually is the class that learns how to serve others. The working class is usually the class that learns how to sacrifice for others. And the poor learns how to teach the others in society how to suffer and to be resilient. All of these are good learnings, and if we don't look at all of these class groups to learn these, we will come out being shortchanged no matter what class we are.
Is that a recipe then for the status quo? It sounds like you've got a machine that's working. The middle class is serving, and others are sacrificing, and others are understanding redemption.
But they're not in each other's
division of labor?
They're not in each other's presence. Mm-hmm. If we had schools that educated all of these categories of people by social class and race together, then the whole society would benefit from from the things that each class is able to give to the whole. And that's what we do not have, because we have become accustomed to our stratified situation. Mm-hmm. And what reason why I talk as strongly as I do about this is because I know the Roman Empire, this isn't integrated. Mm. And so will the United States if we think it can be run by a middle-class value system, or if we think it can be run by a working-class value system. None of these alone is sufficient.
You've got to have a flow between them. Annette Leroux, it would be not difficult to read your book and say these poor kids are doomed to stay at a certain income level if they don't have something like this middle-class upbringing. Are you suggesting that should be the model, that everybody should be shuttled to the soccer game, scheduled all day long, jabbered at with highfalutin vocabulary, right on down the line, cultivated in a concerted fashion?
No, I do not think that should be the model. And I think we should remember that there have been fashions in childbearing just as there are fashions in clothes. I mean, in colonial America, children were seen to be evil. And parents believed that they could beat kids in a way that today would get them arrested for child abuse. So we have a ever-changing notion of what children are like and what our society is like. But the level of inequality in our society is very large. One of the things, when I started to do the study, I naively thought, I could find one school and I would find middle-class kids and poor kids there. And it was just extremely difficult to find a school like that. And if I had, it would have been very rare. Many of the great cities in this country, Chicago, Atlanta, Philadelphia, et cetera, have a lot of poor people in the center and a large suburban ring. And there's just tremendous isolation between different groups of the society, and the inequalities are growing. The rich have more money than the poor. The level of inequality, the divergent pathways are growing.
Let
in
me
this
ask
country.
You something that I kind of found missing in the classic America and sort of self-understanding, right or wrong, the sort of Horatio Alger story of the lower class kid who adopts the posture, the language, even some version of the clothing of the higher class in order to kind of float up, you know, fight up and fit in. Is that going on, or do you see working lower class families in economic terms not even bothering to sort of put on the plumage of the more affluent?
Well, most Americans believe that they're middle class, and most Americans want their children to improve their station in life. But the reality is most kids have a similar social class position to their parents. Or if there's been a change, we've gone from we have fewer manufacturing jobs and now we have more social white-collar jobs. So there are more people who do white-collar work. But the best predictor of the station you'll end up in life is to know your parents' station. That said, there is tremendous, and there is upward mobility and there is downward mobility. And so there's some pattern, but knowing your parents' station will help you understand children's life chances.
Margaret's calling from Boston. Hi, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I grew up working class.
Mm-hmm.
I went to college at a very privileged institution, and I now teach in an institution where most of the students I teach are from and from my perspective growing up, quite privileged, but I think they would all call themselves middle class.
And what do you see?
I see, I'm going to make a vast generalization because I don't think this is true for every kid in every class situation, but I hear a lot of that whining in 21-year-olds. I hear a lot of whining from privileged kids who are struggling with their academics and they feel it's not their responsibility, whereas a lot of the kids I know and who I've taught who are working class have a drive to get ahead because they see the advantage.
So who's on track for success, however you would define that, Margaret?
Well, I think in terms of material success, middle-class kids still have a lot of advantages. They have material advantages. They have the preparation of knowing how to fit into the society and how to function, and they also have, as one of your guests mentioned, that buffer of parental help and support. But the working class kids, I think, are bringing in and will carry in to their work environment a sense of like a work ethic that I just see absent in many middle class kids.
A work ethic and maybe a kind of freedom of mind. I mean, I've seen a kind of tyranny of the mind in some of these affluent families where the mold of success of everything, the cultivation Annette's writing about is so heavily pressed on kids that they may succeed, but it doesn't look too free, not necessarily happy. Margaret, thanks very much for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Annette Leroux, what about happiness? Can we ask about happiness and who is happier?
Well, evidently, people who win the lottery experience a brief moment of happiness, but then return to a set point. And so there's some research that suggests that happiness is really, in some ways, disconnected from people's material circumstances. So, for example, I've interviewed the kids now when they're 20 and 21, and they all pretty much think they're doing pretty well, even if they've dropped out of high school and are working in a blue-collar job. And so the issue of happiness, I think, in some ways isn't as tightly connected as to people's economic circumstances.
Melanie's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Melanie. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Well, I wanted to share my own experience. I'm a 43-year-old woman getting a master's in epidemiology, but I'm a daughter of a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
I just bought my first home. And my comment is that surrounded by academics and, you know, moving into a nice new residence,
yeah,
I still think of myself as a working class progeny and have a hard time identifying with the sort of the PhDs and the doctoral students around me and feel almost a disloyalty in moving in that direction.
And what's the gap that you're uncomfortable in there, Melanie, that you don't identify with?
Well, I think some of the academic world is kind of pointy-headed and disconnected from an emotional life that has been really important to me. My grandfather was a Sicilian immigrant. One of your speakers said something about not forgetting where you come from. And when I look back at my forebears and how hard they worked to get where they were and sort of the tight-knit family connections that we had, I feel that some of that has been lost in my moving forward. I also agree with Margaret's point that I see students in the program where I am, I'm 43, many of them are in their 20s, who really feel a sense of entitlement, and I've had to work very, very hard to get into this master's program as a single mom. It's a very complicated issue, and I think that this discussion has brought out some of the complexities.
So what kind of parenting, then, do you do for your kids? Do you think you're kind of doing a version of the concerted cultivation, scheduled and, you know, nurtured actively at every moment that Annette's writing about, or something more like the accomplishment of natural growth that she's seen in working-class families?
Well, I can illustrate by sharing something that my son said to me when I asked him which was more important to him, Barney or Bishop Tutu. He said Bishop Tutu, so I guess that reveals my orientation. I'm really trying to inculcate in him the idea that materialism is not important, that there are higher values connecting us to other people that are to me, need to be at the forefront of the way I live my life. And he's 5 and a half, so I'm proud that I hear that. I don't think it's just rote. I think he really does feel some of those things because that's what I give him through my sort of emotional connection to him.
Mm, good for you. And right there, you're singing Charles Willie's song. Though even just talking Bishop Tutu, that's kind of fancy, Melanie. but we hear it and we like it, and we thank you for your call. So here we are, Charles Willie. You've got this great big view. Annette's been more focused specifically on the home and family life. What does it leave you thinking about social, I mean, if this comes down to decisions we make together rather than in our individual family, it comes down to both, but for those we make together, what does it all suggest to you?
Well, it suggests to me that society ought to be concerned about promoting justice. Justice is necessary for middle-class people, is necessary for working-class people, and it's necessary for low-income people. Justice is fairness, as John Rawls would say it, and that's what we need in our society. And middle-class people need justice. Poor people need justice. Working-class people need justice. And if that's what being educated together teaches us to do, how to achieve justice in our societies instead of how to hoard as much as we can hoard for ourselves and forget about us. Because if we do that, then we'll have more gated communities.
But if privilege accretes to those middle-class kids getting this kind of upbringing, is that a bar to justice?
No, that's what I say. They don't get, but they may not understand justice very well.
Annette Leroux, what's your sense as a culture, as a community? How do we respond to what you've learned here? Is there an institutional response or not?
I think there could be and should be an institutional response. I mean, schools in America are vastly unequal, and many middle-class parents would never send their kids to, say, inner-city schools. And I think we have a duty as a country to look at equalization of our schools. But even though schools are unequal, they're much more equal than childcare. And so actually, kids do learn more in schools than they'd learn in the summer. And schools play a crucial role in helping to smooth out the inequalities in the country. And I think we need to look at our institutions to help provide a way and for teachers to be more flexible in their thinking about how parents can support them. And sometimes by turning over responsibility to the educator, parents are supporting teachers.
Well, our time is very short. In a word, have you come away from this intimate exploration optimistic or more worried?
Well, I'm comforted by how deeply all parents care for their kids and how much parents want kids to succeed and how important family is for children and for everybody. In the end, there are only 24 hours in a day and people have to make important choices.
Annette Leroux, author of Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family Life, thanks very much for your research and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Charles Willie with me here in the studio, Professor Emeritus at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. Professor Willie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's nice to talk with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.